absolutely. So, our next speaker is Dr. Jean-Luc Dianing. He is USDA research geneticist based at Cornell University in the plant breeding and genetics department. Has been there since 2007. Before that, he filled Ken Fry's shoes as the oat breeder at Iowa State University. Degrees from University of Minnesota, Maine, and I'll ask you to start off.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks for inviting me. Just a clarification, I would never presume to fill Ken Fry's shoes. All right, let me just launch in. I work a lot with Mark, and so we had to figure out how to not overlap too much, but fortunately I think my mind works pretty differently from Mark's. My talk is very much conceptual rather than empirical. Yeah? Okay, so I only put my own name as an author of this talk, but there are really many people who have contributed. I'll show slides that with graphs that came from Julie Dawson and Jeff Endelman's work. They're postdocs in my lab. Also from Nicola, who you've heard about. And so I have many people to thank who have sort of inspired some of the thinking that you'll hear about. And then, of course, people who funded the work. Okay, so this is an outline of my talk. There's sort of two components. So I'm not going to introduce genomic selection at all, right? So the first thing you got to realize is that I believe that genomic selection is going to work, that we get accuracies that are high enough that we're going to make more rapid progress by making selections on the basis of predictions from these statistical models than we will from taking the time to evaluate stuff in the field. Now, I hasten to add that doing phenotyping is still the most important thing that a breeder is ever going to do. That, if you don't have good phenotypes, your models aren't going to be doing a good job of prediction, and that you want as much phenotypic data as you can. But you're not going to be using that phenotypic data for selection. You're going to be using it for model development. So with the assumption that genomic selection works, here's sort of a snapshot of my thinking about it. There are things about genomic selection that I really like, and that I'll talk about. So the speed of the breeding cycle, Mark touched on it. The fact that you're evaluating alleles rather than lines. The fact that you have all this genotypic data, it allows you to manage the diversity of the population while you're selecting it in a much richer way than you can when you're just doing phenotypic selection. And then a kind of a nerdy aspect of it, which is that I think it deals with uncertainty correctly. At least that's one of the aims of genomic selection. But of course, it is a black box, and you are selecting things without ever seeing things in the field, or at least it has the potential to go that route. So there's aspects of it that are frightening, right? And so one of these is the same as one of the things that I like, which is has to do with this how fast you're moving forward. And the other one, I think, has to do with sort of the stage of where we're at least in the public sector and genomic selection, which is that the accuracies of our models, there's a fair amount of variability from one subpopulation to the next and so forth. And we don't really know why that's happening. And so that's potentially can lead us astray, I guess. All right, so the things I like. I'll start with the good stuff. So the speed of the breeding cycle. So this is a schematic of traditional phenotypic selection in a crop that requires inbreeding prior to selection. So somewhat arbitrarily, I'm decomposing this into seasons. So it takes one season to cross. It maybe takes two seasons to inbreed a crop. And then it takes a couple years to phenotype it properly before you can say, okay, this is a line that I really like that I'm going to select as a parent. And then there's, the sort of tail end of it is you take the ones that you like and you pipeline them out for release. So if you assume that you can do three seasons per year, then this breeding cycle takes about 3 years. So then enter genomic selection. With genomic selection, you select on the basis of genotypes, which you can get from a seed or a seedling. You don't have to spend the time to inbreed the thing and bring it out to the fields before you can select on it. And so potentially you can do a cycle of selection for every season. So in my little schematic here, that takes about a third of the year, or 1/9 the amount of time. And 1/9 is maybe pushing it a little bit, but certainly tripling the speed of this, the selection cycle, is going to be feasible. And you know, a tenfold increase is not out of the question by any stretch of the imagination. So why is this so cool? Here's the cumulative selection response equation. So you have, Mark showed it too, the selection intensity, the correlation between the index, or the thing that you're selecting on, the selection criterion, and the true breeding value. And then this is the additive standard deviation. This accumulates. As you do several cycles, the standardized selection intensity just adds on itself. So I've set up two kinds of breeding cycles here, a phenotypic one that has a pretty strong selection intensity, and then the standardized selection differential is 2.4, and then what I call fast genomic selection, whatever, that has much lower selection intensity, and I do that because of fear of increasing inbreeding or losing diversity. Much lower selection intensity, so the selection differential for one cycle is much smaller, but you're doing 9 cycles. And so all of a sudden you have six times higher standardized selection intensity. And it's a much more efficient way of getting high intensity than increasing the number of lines that you're looking at or trying to increase their heritability. Okay, so this is the other. This is probably one of my the favorite thing. I think this is more or less what Gary was referring to when he said, "Okay, now plant breeding is going to change really fast." So historically, we phenotyped lines, we evaluated them to select them, right? Now selection is based on alleles. So in other words, the revolution, or the turning itself on its head aspect of genomic selection, is that we don't phenotype lines for selection anymore. And I'm giving you the extremes, okay? If you want to phenotype lines to select them, more power to you. But in the extreme of genomic selection, the purpose of phenotyping is to select a model and parameterize the model. And all selection takes place on the basis of the model. So on the basis of genotypes. Okay, so in particular, what you need to do for this is you need to evaluate alleles. And so in that context, a line that you go out to and bring to the field, it's just a carrier of alleles. There's nothing very special about that line itself. I mean, you may go on and select it if it turns out to be really good, but at this stage of evaluating alleles, it's just a bag of alleles, right? So the thing that you need to replicate, because this is the thing that you're evaluating, the thing that you need to replicate is the alleles. You don't need to replicate the lines. And so the consequence of this is that you have huge flexibility in terms of how many lines you want to evaluate and how you want to do it across treatments and environments. So you're not constrained by the need to run multi-environment trials with many reps of a given line to get an accurate take on the line. The accurate take on the line has already occurred when you had it as a seedling and you genotyped it. Okay, so when you genotype, you get all this information about what's in the line that you don't get when you phenotype. And so if you're managing the diversity of your breeding population, what you need to be thinking about is which alleles you're at risk of losing. And obviously those alleles are the rare alleles, right? If they're rare, they only occur in one or two lines in your population. And if you don't happen to select those lines for the next generation, then those alleles are lost. So genomic selection, on the other hand, gives you an evaluation of the effect of a given allele. And if it's favorable and it's rare, then you can say, okay, I really want to keep this allele in my population, even if it's not present in a line that I think is going to perform terribly well. So I've run simulations on this with a sort of standard genomic selection model where I'm not worrying about weighting these alleles, or I'm not trying to manage specifically the diversity of the population, versus a weighted approach that does indeed sort of try to maintain in the population rare favorable alleles. And so these graphs show breeding cycles. So it's simulations. Nobody's done 10 cycles of genomic selection yet, I don't think, not even in the private sector. And then on y-axis is across the replications of the simulations, how many favorable alleles were lost. So this is the rate for phenotypic selection, and this was how many were lost for genomic selection using either a small or a large training population. So large training population is better than small, right? So being low down is a good thing here. But as soon as you start to try to manage this, genomic selection can do better than phenotypic selection at maintaining alleles in the population, even though you have twice as many selection bottleneck events in this genomic selection simulation. So I think this offers a lot of opportunity for clever use of the information that we have on alleles to optimize both the population and the path that you're going to use to get to an ideal genotype. Okay, so this idea of handling uncertainty correctly. So the deal is that there's always error variance, right? I mean, no matter what you do, you're going to have error associated with effect estimates. These estimates, they lead to breeding decisions. By and large, we're forced to make breeding decisions as if the estimates that we had were represented perfect knowledge. But in fact, if you assume perfect knowledge, you may make decisions that are suboptimal relative to recognizing that that there's error associated with the estimates. So, you know, the initial breakthrough for genomic selection really was, again, in this large P, many predictors, few observations context, was to treat these marker effects as random effects. And so then you recognize that the error variance plays a role in how you want to estimate these values. So that was 2001, the Mayerson paper. I think further, as we move down this path, the Bayesian approach is what they allow is they give you a representation of the full spectrum of possibilities for the joint effects. And so you can use that in making selections for the next generation, but also in thinking about downstream consequences for a pathway toward optimizing the genotype. Okay. Okay, good. So things that scare me a little. So there's two reasons why the speed of the breeding cycle in genomic selection is a little frightening. So every time you have a selection event, it's a bottleneck, right? You only select a limited number of individuals. Each time you do that, there's risk of losing genetic diversity. So the faster you go, the faster you lose genetic variability. There's also the fact that these genomic selection models, once you've estimated the model or parameterized it, it's not like its accuracy is constant. As you move forward with generations of mating or selection, the accuracy of the model decays. And so if I'm doing 9 cycles of genomic selection in the time that it takes me to do 1 cycle of phenotypic selection, the 1 cycle of phenotypic selection sort of represents how quickly I can add new phenotypes to the genomic selection model. The adding phenotypes to the genomic selection model is going to refresh it and increase its accuracy after the accuracy has decayed. But if you're doing 9 cycles in the time that it would take you to do 1, you have 9 cycles during which that accuracy is decaying. So, you know, this is something that empirically we just don't have experience with yet, is how far down are our model's accuracy going to decay in the process of all these cycles. So again, with that simulation that I showed, this is just a little schema explaining how it works. It was a pretty modest kind of thought on the acceleration of the breeding cycle through genomic selection. So here's a schematic for phenotypic selection where you take one season. Season doesn't really mean anything. I should have just say a unit of time here, but one unit of time for crossing and inbreeding, one unit of time to evaluate and select. So it basically takes you 2 units of time to go through one cycle, one breeding cycle, and so each cycle is color-coded. Genomic selection, on the other hand, so you start out in the same way because you're developing a training population, but then what's you know, the proper of genomic selection is that you're going to select before you evaluate. So it still takes you one unit of time to evaluate, but you've already done your selection. So the upshot is that you can select every unit of time, whereas in phenotypic selection, you select every other unit of time. So the assumption here is that I'm increasing the breeding cycle twofold. And here's what it does in terms of losing genetic diversity, right? So this is the unweighted model, so it's a sort of standard genomic selection model. Here's phenotypic selection. So you can see that doing two cycles of selection of genomic selection per cycle of phenotypic selection means that you take off faster, right? You have more rapid early gain from selection with genomic selection. On the other hand, the phenotypic selection isn't losing as many alleles, and you can see that after a little while, genomic selection has petered out. I mean, it's a closed recurrent selection system, so we're not introducing new alleles in there. But all of the favorable alleles have been lost. And so, you know, I mean, obviously, this wouldn't necessarily stop you in an empirical case. You would just recross these with other material that came from outside of the population. But it's something to think about and worry about a little bit. Here's what accuracy looked like. So I should say genomic selection accuracy is here. Phenotypic selection accuracy is here. It peters out simply because at a certain point there's no genetic variability left anymore. What I want to focus on here is the zigzag component of this. And essentially what's going on here is that here, when you're at the peak of the zigzag, you have high accuracy because you've just refreshed your genomic selection model with new phenotypic information. And here, you've done one cycle without refreshing the genomic selection model. And so you can clearly see that accuracy gets relatively rapidly lost and that you need to refresh it as quickly as you can. So this is just another actual simulation paper looking at this phenomenon. It's a busy graph. There are generations of random mating here on the x-axis and the accuracy on the y-axis. It shows a number of different models. I'm focusing on this green one and the blue one. The blue one is actually the decay of accuracy that you would get if you were using strictly the pedigree to make predictions. So pedigree predictions decay very rapidly. It's interesting that the shape is the same, basically, for all models. And this is a rigid regression decay of accuracy. But you can see that the initial decay of accuracy is relatively steep, and then you reach some kind of a plateau where it decays relatively constant, at a constant rate. But the point is that if you're doing nine cycles of genomic selection in the time that it takes you to get some decent phenotypes, your accuracy is decayed to down here. And mostly what we've been reporting in the literature is, you know, stuff that we get around here. Okay, so relative to the two cycles of genomic selection versus one cycle of phenotypic selection, the situation is more dire than that, because we do want to accelerate the breeding cycle much more than twofold, ideally. And really, the best remedy is to start with as big a training population as you can. So if there's any take-home message that you get from this talk, it's this second bullet point. Okay, so the second thing that scares me a little bit is this accuracy variability. So what I'm about to show you is work from Julie Dawson and Jeff Endelman, with thanks to the CIMMYT people who've given us data from the semi-arid wheat yield trial over the last 17 years. So if you look at cross-validation where you take out 80% of the data, you take out 20% of the data, you train on 80%, and then you predict the 20%. But you do this at random, right? The 20% that you take out, you take it out at random. You get really nice, this is for grain yield, really nice cross-validation accuracies, okay? I mean, I think this is very high, a very high accuracy. On the other hand, if you don't do the folds, the folds of the cross-validation at random, but you predict each year with the phenotypic information that came from previous years, okay? So Okay, so another busy graph, so years on the x-axis. This blue line is the size of the training population. So every year I'm adding new lines to my training population because every year I have new lines that are going into this semi-arid wheat yield trial. And then the red line is the accuracy that I get for, say, predicting 1999 on the basis of 1994 to 1998. This red line here was the accuracy that I got from the random folds in the cross-validation. And you can see that basically when I do the cross-validation year by year instead of at random, I almost never hit what I got at random. And basically what this is telling me is that lines are more related within years than they are across years. And so when I pick some out at random, I always have in my training population some representatives of that year. And it's a funny thing, you know, statisticians will always tell you, you got to randomize. And in this case, proper randomization seems to me leads to something that's a little bit misleading. The other thing that's, you know, again, scary about this graph is that as my training population size has gone up, it's not like my accuracy has been following, which is, you know, what theory would predict. In fact, it's taking a dive in the last couple of years that we can't explain, right? And so what does this mean? I don't know. It's an empirical problem. So here's another empirical case of this variability and accuracy. So this is beta-glucan content in oats. Similar deal where we have lines that are from 2004 to 2007 that we're using as the validation population. And then we're predicting those lines using either lines from 2001 to 2003, 1998 to 2003, or 1994 to 2003. So in this case, again, the train population is getting bigger and bigger as we go further back in time. And for beta-glucan, it works out very nicely. You get, you know, increased accuracy as you make the train population bigger. But what does it look like for grain yield? Well, first of all, it's much lower accuracy, and I have an excuse for why the accuracy is so low. I don't think it really means that it's that bad. But the thing that's, again, frightening is that here we added a whole bunch of lines to the training population here, and the accuracy went down. So what does that mean? It's not entirely clear how to work with things like this. A third case, so Nicolas has done some analyses across a number of data sets. And so some of these data sets could be split into subpopulations, and so not all subpopulations were equally accurately predicted, right? Here in the most extreme case, and I am showing you the most extreme case, so it's not always this bad, but in Mark's wheat, he had one subpopulation that was incredibly well predicted and two subpopulations that were not predicted at all. So again, we don't know exactly why this is. There is a certain amount of variability in the prediction that just comes from random sampling. So I've run very quick sort of simulations of this process using a simple additive model, and I always come up sort of toward the low end of this standard deviation. In other words, this standard deviation of 0.3 between accuracies of subpopulations is due to something other, I think, than just sampling noise. Right. Okay, so I've shown you some cool things and some scary things. I think the rewards far outweigh the risks. Of course, this is my line of business, but these features of genomic selection, I think, just offer tremendous advantages. Again, the take-home message is build up as big of a training population as you can initially. So phenotyping is critical. Just because we're getting the 500,000 markers per line doesn't mean that you can give up phenotyping. And the last thing that I really should have tried to talk to you more about in this talk is that I think genomic selection is also exciting because I think it can usher in a lot of cooperation between small public sector programs. And so just briefly, the way I would characterize that is this, that, you know, say I have a wheat breeding program in New York. To some extent, it's valuable for me to evaluate lines from Ohio because every now and then a line from Ohio will perform well in New York, and I can use it as a parent. But in the genomic selection era, even if I never get a good line out of Ohio, it's valuable to me to evaluate these Ohio lines because I'm going to be assessing alleles that exist in the Ohio program and how they perform in my environment. And so I think genomic selection and the whole process of model building should make it much more valuable for people to exchange germplasm and cooperate along those lines. So that's it. Yeah, questions? In the back there? Right, so for sure, a main component of the decay of the accuracy of genomic selection is that recombinations are occurring and markers that were in LD with QTL alleles no longer are. Another component of it is that the markers are reaching fixation. There was another hand in the back? You're right. So you probably don't get a very accurate estimate of the effect of the allele if it's rare. On the other hand, you get an estimate, and if it's in the direction that you want, you can weight it more heavily. I mean, in what I showed, I didn't cheat with the simulation and tell the analysis which alleles were favorable and which alleles were not favorable. It had to figure that out on its own. So it can work.
So, when you can do, when you can speed up the breeding process like 9 times,
right?
You need to make your release at some point, and you need to stop collecting from that population, right?
Well, okay, so the way I would view this is that you have an open cycle or an open recurrent selection population, and you're just spinning off lines that you're going to inbreed and phenotype very carefully before you release them to farmers. But you're just spinning off lines every year. Yeah, I mean, I think exactly how best to open the recurrent selection population when you're using genomic selection, that's an important both theoretical and empirical question.
If I can make one comment, I'll take speaker's prerogative. I think that two-circle model is probably, I don't know, should be retired. Because I don't think that the separation between training populations and product development will be very very strict in real life. I think the way we're likely to be applying it, at least initially at CIMID, is that the product development stream will provide the estimates that go into the model, and we'll rapid cycle certain populations based on those estimates. With that, I think we better take our 10-minute coffee break. Thank you very much.